Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. This is a rebroadcast of our show, so we won't be taking any phone calls, but we thought we'd bring you on this Memorial Day weekend a few recent segments related to our military and life in the armed forces. Again, the phones are not open, but our comments page always is at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. President Obama plans to send 17,000 more troops to join the 36,000 or so already serving in Afghanistan. One former U.S. Army captain who fought there has written a memoir about his service and the years of preparation from West Point to Oxford, he was a Rhodes Scholar, to the swamps of Florida that went into making a battle-ready leader. Craig Mullaney's book is The Unforgiving Minute, A Soldier's Education. It's just out from the Penguin Press. Maybe you even saw him on The Daily Show last night. Captain Mullaney, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start your story at the beginning. What led you to join the military and to go to West Point?
My grandfather was a mechanic in the Army Air Corps back in World War II, and he used to have these incredible stories about his time and this sense of service that I think as a young child I started to absorb. And when I went and visited West Point for the first time and I walked around this incredibly beautiful campus and I saw the sense of purpose in the eyes of these cadets. And I think that sense of purpose and the concept of service, and I think that 17-year-old yearning for adventure and seeing the wider world beyond my small town in Rhode Island pulled me into the academy.
How unusual is it to be a West Point cadet and a Rhodes Scholar, to have had both of those experiences?
I feel extraordinarily lucky to have had that sort of the yin and the yang of an education. But it turns out in my class there were four Rhodes Scholars from West Point. And there's a long history of Rhodes Scholars coming out of the academy. But you couldn't pick two institutions more different in the way they approach learning.
For example,
you know, at West Point, you know, everything is scheduled down to the minute, and there is no extra space in the day. And when I arrived at Oxford, it took me 5 weeks to find my supervisor. I had no syllabus, no books, and I had to really—
Intellectual freedom.
Oh, complete intellectual freedom, and I loved it, being able to kind of find my intellectual curiosity and follow where it went. But I looked at this blank calendar, and I said, what do I do with these 600 minutes unaccounted for, you know, once I blocked off time for reading and sleep?
Because your body was already on military time, right?
Well, it was a week after I finished Ranger School that I arrived at Oxford. So, I was about as militarized as anyone could be at that point.
How about the training to be an officer that you get at West Point and how it's different from the training that an enlisted man receives?
That's a good question. It's a longer period of time, certainly, before you're in a position of leadership. At West Point's 4 years. And over the course of the 4 years, what they try to do is put you in scenario after scenario where you're in a leadership role, and it's a controlled environment, and you get to practice and learn from your mistakes and learn from the mistakes of those around you and become a better leader over time.
And you're very eloquent about that burden of leadership in the book and about the toll it took on you when one of your men died in a battle in Afghanistan. Do you think that sense of responsibility is found throughout the military?
I think so. You know, on the first day arriving at West Point, they tell you as a new cadet in this basic training environment that you have four responses to any question. Yes, sir. No, sir. No excuse, sir. Sir, I do not understand. And it's that no excuse, sir, that you say a couple thousand times over the course of 4 years. It really, you internalize it. And that's the price of the salute you receive as a leader in the military, because you have that weight of responsibility on your shoulders, that you're responsible for these sons and daughters and, you know, in many cases, parents.
You're allowed to say, I don't understand.
I think that's actually an important lesson that you learn at the academy, is when you don't know something, don't fake it. The proper answer is, sir, I do not understand, but I'll go and find out.
Works in civilian life, too. Some politicians might do well to say that once in a while, more than they do. Your book explores the question of what can and can't be taught about war and about leadership. And you yourself taught history at the Naval Academy before leaving the service. So how do you teach a student to lead? What can be taught? What can't be taught?
Well, certainly every student, every cadet and midshipman comes into the academy with a certain set of values and character traits. And I don't know that you can teach someone honesty and integrity and courage in an academic institution. But what I thought I could teach them was this habit of mine of asking questions. And this back to this, sir, I do not understand. That when you arrive in a place like Afghanistan or Iraq or who knows where my former students will find themselves 10 years from now, they're not going to have all the answers, but they need to know what questions to ask and to have enough of that sort of intellectual toolkit to explore and improve, because that's their responsibility as a leader, to understand the operating environment, their context for their soldiers.
You can't teach courage. You can't teach integrity. Can you train toward those things?
I think you can. We do a lot of it, not in the classroom per se, but on the athletic field. And so in my case, it was often in the boxing ring. And you learn how to take a punch and get back up. And that's something about resolve and something about courage. Because at least every time I got in the boxing ring, and I had an illustrious record of 0-6, every time I got in the boxing ring, I knew I was going to get pummeled. I had a glass jaw, and I went down nearly every boxing match. But to be able to go back out again, knowing that I'm going to get pummeled, and that's a bit about courage, which I don't think is the absence of fear, but being able to face fear and continue.
Craig Mullaney, my guest on WNYC, his new book, The Unforgiving Minute, A Soldier's Education, and we can take phone calls for him. Anybody who's been through West Point or any military experience yourself, want to compare notes? We'll talk more about policy in Afghanistan, too, and the particular war in which he fought as we go here at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I gather your brother, Gary, also went to West Point, and that you're prepared to read for us something from your book where you talk about what you'd want him to learn there?
Yeah, this book is something of an open letter to my brother and to his peers. He graduated 7 years behind me, and sort of like two Rangers passing in the night, as he finished Ranger school, that was my last day in uniform. And so I wanted to summarize in words what I couldn't say to him. And this is at his graduation. There was so much I wanted to say that I wasn't sure where to start. I wanted him to know that the greatest privilege I ever had was leading men in combat. He was going to be tested over and over again in ways he could never predict or simulate in training. There were going to be times when he would be afraid, but I wanted him to know that courage had more to do with facing that fear than forgetting it. His men would expect him to share their risks and to stand with them in the storm, but they would also expect him to set a course, decide, act, and lead. He couldn't afford to doubt himself. The only way to never make a decision he would regret would be to never make any decisions at all. Finally, I wanted to tell him that doing everything right might still entail heart-wrenching consequences. Gary would have his own unforgiving minutes, I feared, but what mattered was that he filled those minutes with 60 seconds worth of distance run. And just as important were all the hours of demanding preparation before the unforgiving minute. The education and training, the running and marching, the deliberate planning married to decisive action. His men expected no more than everything he had. They deserved no less. Yet the only way Gary would be able to measure success would be to look in the mirror. But even as these thoughts ran through my head, I realized how little I could convey in a few phrases. The rest Gary would have to learn for himself. As we hugged, I whispered in his ear, "Take care of your men." It was all I could think to say.
Where is he today?
He's at Fort Stewart. Down in Savannah, Georgia. He returned from Iraq in December and will likely deploy to Afghanistan next year.
Alex in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Alex.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to say that I was in ROTC and I am currently an Army captain in the reserves. and that I just wanted to get the guest Craig's view on the difference between ROTC and West Point. And I also wanted to ask him kind of an inside question. What class did you graduate Ranger School from? Because I graduated 08-02. So.
Alex, that's, I think we may have been in the same Ranger class, actually. I was class, I think I started in class 802 and finished in class 902 in September of 2000. Yeah, it's a,
Did you recycle?
I did. I recycled the mountain phase.
Yeah, I mean, up in Dahlonega? Yeah, same
up in
here.
Dahlonega.
I did that for a Best Ranger competition.
How come you guys don't know each other? How many people are in this class?
Oh, dear Lord.
With shaved heads, everyone starts to look alike.
Oh, yes, we do.
So when you say recycle, what does that mean?
If you, in Ranger School, it's three phases of about 3 weeks each, and if you don't pass all the tests, then sometimes you have the opportunity to repeat the phase and do it over again. And so, I didn't pass the mountain phase, the second phase, the first time I went through, and I had to do it all over again.
And you told John Stewart last night that Ranger School was harder than Afghanistan.
Oh yeah, I'd go back to Afghanistan before I'd go back to Ranger School. I don't know. Alex might agree with me about that.
Those RIs are no joke. Let's just put it that way. They're rough.
And did you have a question about Iraq also, Alex?
I also had a question. Basically, I wanted to ask the difference between ROTC West Point and between Iraq and Afghanistan, either from his personal experience or from just what he's heard from people. Because I was mm-hmm. in Iraq, but it was, you know, back in 2003, so things I'm sure have changed.
Yeah. I don't know what to say about the difference between ROTC and West Point. I'm a prisoner of my own personal experience, and not having been in an ROTC program, I can't attest to how it prepares its officers. I do think that we should have more ROTC programs across the country, and it's a shame that we've shuttered so many over the last 30 years. On the question of Iraq and Afghanistan and what the differences are, I think actually if you ask someone who served in Iraq last year, they would have a very different experience than you had 6 years ago. And I think that's certainly the case for Afghanistan, that everyone fights their own war. And mine is very different than someone who's fighting today. And from one valley to the next, the fight, the operating environment can be totally different. More broadly speaking, Afghanistan is a much larger country. It's about 50% larger than Iraq. Afghanistan's about the size of Texas. And you have a similar sort of Texas-Mexico border about the length of the border with Pakistan. It's very rugged terrain. There aren't many roads. It's about three times as poor as Iraq. And so the challenges are significant as we move forward.
Alex, thanks a lot for calling us. Good luck to you. My guest is Craig Mullaney, author of The Unforgiving Minute, A Soldier's Education. I heard something about you possibly getting an appointment having to do with Afghanistan from the Obama administration. Can you confirm or deny that?
I can't. I would love to serve in an Obama administration, and my experience advising President Obama during his campaign and during the transition was
incredibly rewarding. You worked on the campaign.
I did. 10 days after I left the Army, I was in Chicago, and 2 days after that, I was flying on a plane with President Obama.
So this idea of negotiating with the Taliban, was that your idea?
No. I think the term negotiating with the Taliban means different things to different people. When I look at what are the opportunities to peel folks away from the Taliban, I don't think in terms of negotiating with Taliban leaders. I think about how do you get those foot soldiers who are oftentimes are doing it because they could get paid more as Taliban foot soldiers than they could in their local village or by joining the national forces.
Really? So when Vice President Biden said something like 70% of the fighters would lay down their arms if given the chance, and he's taken a lot of mocking for that, from your experience in country, do you think that's about accurate?
Well, I would say, I mean, farmers in our area would get $25, anywhere between $25 and $200 for pointing a rocket in the direction of our base. They had no personal vendetta against me or my men. Oftentimes, I mean, if you are on the edge of survival, which many Afghans are, this is a country that's been brutalized over 30 years, and someone offers you $200 to just look the other way, I think it's hard for them to not take that offer when it's their families, you know, putting bread on the table. And so, you know, when I look forward, I think it's not about if given the chance, it's about if you can provide better opportunities for Afghans, then I think that helps shut down the recruiting base for the Taliban.
What's our mission in Afghanistan? How would you define victory?
I mean, that's a question for President Obama that I think the part of this review they've been conducting is to answer. You know, as I look at it, I think at a minimal level, you hope that in Afghanistan and also, you know, on the other side of the border in Pakistan, that you have stable civilian governments that are not at significant risk of being toppled by insurgents. I also think as we look regionally, we don't want that part of the world to be a place where transnational terrorist strikes are either planned or people receive their training. Those are two really hard missions to accomplish.
Is one dependent on the other? Do we have to have stable democratic governments in Afghanistan and Pakistan in order to protect America from another 9/11 planned in those mountains?
I think that where we see sanctuary for transnational terrorist strikes, it tends to be in those areas where there's a great degree of instability in the local government. The Al-Qaeda and Taliban thrives in a vacuum of power.
Is the war even winnable on those terms? As you know, the British and the Soviets, to name two, couldn't tame Afghanistan to its end.
I think we have a very different approach to the problem than either the Brits or the Russians did. I think it's going to take a long time. I mean, we look at sort of the history of counterinsurgency. It can take up to a decade. Now, that doesn't mean a decade of American forces dying in great numbers, but it means it's probably going to take 10 years, to really stabilize the situation.
Howard in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Craig Mullaney, author of The Unforgiving Minute, A Soldier's Education. Hello.
Hi, Craig. Yes, this is Howard. It's reported that over a million civilians died in Iraq, and thousands of civilians have died in Afghanistan following the U.S. bombings and invasion. How do you square your training at West Point and your personal beliefs, your integrity, with the deaths of so many civilians, which, by the way, is even greater, I understand, than the number of civilians who've died in Darfur? And do you see yourself as having participated in a war crime, given the kind of lies and misrepresentations that have been put forward by the previous administration?
Craig?
Tough
question.
Yeah,
series
it's a tough
of questions.
Question.
Well, how about the relationship between the individual soldier and the policy?
Yeah, I mean, as a leader, I take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution and to follow the legal orders of my superior officers up to my commander in chief. And I certainly had disagreements with the policies while I was in Afghanistan in 2003. But, you know, I tried to do the best job I could in my area and to execute a mission that I thought was legal. I think there is a larger question, though, about civilian casualties in a counterinsurgency. And it can be counterproductive. And it's one of those things that you want to use the minimal force possible to achieve your ends.
We have a few minutes left with Craig Mullaney, author of The Unforgiving Minute, A Soldier's Education. On what we were just talking about, you read Michael Walzer's on Just and Unjust Wars, right?
I did.
How did that prepare you for actual fighting?
I think it's important to grapple with the first principles and with the morality of warfare before you're in a situation when the bullets are flying, and to give yourself, sort of condition your mind to understand those parameters.
It's very unusual for a soldier to think it through that intellectually, isn't it?
I don't think that's necessarily the case. I mean, every cadet in my class read Walzer while we were at the academy, and we spent a lot of time thinking through the moral
dilemmas
of warfare.
That's at West Point, so that's the elite.
And I think also during my training at Fort Benning when I was with other officers, and it's something I talked a lot about with my men. And that's one of these roles you have as a platoon leader, that you're a teacher, you're a guidance counselor, you're a social worker, a financial advisor.
And then you're a morality coach.
Yeah, it's important though.
So how does that come into play, for example, to another part of Howard's question, mm-hmm. with respect to civilians? Because obviously you never want to kill civilians, and some of the times You obviously feel you have to.
My personal experience may be unique. Afghanistan is – where I operated was a very sparsely populated place. And the large firefights and battles I had were on as – I mean there were no civilians in that battle space.
Or to put another way, there are risks that militaries take that are not targeted at civilians, but they know statistically some civilians are going to die. And they are morally very complicated questions.
No, you're right. It's very tricky. But I also know that I protected a lot of Afghans through our operations. I helped a lot of Afghans. And the security that my men provided at great personal risk allowed some Afghans to live more prosperous lives, not be intimidated by the Taliban.
We just have a half a minute left. I know you can't comment on whether any appointment is in the works, but Spencer Ackerman in the Washington Independent was very excited that you and a fellow former captain might go to the Pentagon. Why is it important that platoon leaders, as a matter of generality, be part of the civilian leadership? And we have 20 seconds.
Yeah, I think it's very important to capture the wisdom, not just of officers who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also sergeants and soldiers. And something that I have encouraged President Obama to do, and he's listened to, is to have policy informed by those who've been where the rubber meets the road.
Craig Mullaney, he is the author of The Unforgiving Minute, A Soldier's Education, a very, very thoughtful reflection of his training and then some of his experiences as an Army captain in Afghanistan. Good luck. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.